I want to talk about Galilean Genesis, which is a model I developed with Creminelli and Trincherini, which partially builds on some work I've done in the past few years with these people, of which Leonardo is in the audience. So this is the standard Big Bang cosmology, okay, in a plane in which you plot the Hubble constants versus t, and of course you have the Big Bang here, and then Hubble constant decreases with time. Inflation is a mild deformation of this, if you want, so it solves many problems, well, many, if you want, two problems mostly, the horizon problem and the curvature problem, and that's done by halting for a second, going back in time, for a second, for a fraction of a second, going back in time, the rise of the Hubble constant. It still has the Big Bang in the past, okay? I want to tell a very different story, okay, which corresponds to this picture, and it's a story, it's a cosmology in which the horizon problem and also the flatness problem, as we will see, are solved by having actually Minkowski space in the asymptotic past, okay? The universe expands, reaches a maximum Hubble constant, and then reheats and radiation dominance takes over. Now, of course, it's a very unconventional story, and maybe it would fit better in among yesterday's talks about alternatives. I'm flattered that I've been put in the day of fundamental theory, so the best I can do, it's a lot of responsibility, of course, so the best I can do is try to tell this story while trying to be very conventional, okay? So I will try to respect all sacred principles of quantum field theory. Maybe this is too reactionary, okay? Maybe to have interesting stories for the early universe, we have to be a little more revolutionary, but I'll try to stick to tradition, okay? As far as quantum field theory is concerned. So, essentially, I want to get rid of the Big Bang, okay? And this is difficult because of the null energy condition. So let me review briefly what's so important about the null energy condition and why do we care about it. So the energy conditions in GR are essentially the statement that energy should be positive. But of course, in GR, you have to make it a covariant statement. And the fundamental energy object in GR is the stress energy tensor. And so you have to take covariant contractions of the stress energy tensor and impose inequalities on those. And you get different energy conditions this way, inequivalent. Some are stronger, some are weaker. Okay? And there's many. Probably I'm forgetting some. And of all these energy conditions, the null one, which I'm going to call neck, stands out as the most robust. And the reason is the following. So first of all, what's the statement? The null energy condition is the statement that if you contract the stress energy tensor with any null vector, you get something non-negative. And it's the most robust of all because it is saturated by a cosmological constant. Okay, G mu nu contracted with a null vector gives zero. So you cannot evade it or fix it by playing with the cosmological constant. Whereas the other energy conditions don't have this property, so I can evade them by, for instance, choosing a large enough cosmological constant on top of some totally sensible physical system. So they are somewhat ambiguous. In order to impose that they are satisfied, you should somehow subtract the cosmological constant, but this is not always a well-defined process because the cosmological constant is not defined locally in field space. It's some sort of global concept in field space. So on the other hand, for cosmology, so if you apply the null energy condition to a cosmological fluid with which is homogeneous and isotropic, you get the statement that rho plus p should be non-negative. And for flat, I should say it after Gonzalo's talk, for flat cosmologies, this implies that h dot should be negative or non-positive, okay? So if the null energy condition is obeyed, h dot is negative, h wants to decrease, and you're left with the question, well, if h wants to decrease, why is the universe expanding in the first place? This is, of course, a psychological question. It's not a very scientific question. The implication being that psychology is not a science. But And so the standard answer is that the universe is expanding because of the initial conditions at the Big Bang, okay? So if you obey the analogy condition throughout the cosmic history, you have the Big Bang in your past. And in order to talk about the initial conditions, you need the UV completion of gravity, which maybe is the way it is, okay? But it would be also nice to have a consistent story within quantum field theory, weakly coupled to general relativity. So the question I want to address is the following, then. Can one construct a sensible quantum field theory that violates the null energy condition, okay? And this is difficult usually because of stability, okay? Usually stability implies the null energy condition. And the simplest example is, of course, take a scalar field with the potential and the standard kinetic energy, but leave open the possibility that this is either plus or minus, okay? Now look at the cosmological solution in which the scalar field is a function of time, and you'll discover that the combination entering the neck is exactly plus or minus phi do square, where this plus or minus is precisely this plus or minus. So if you want to violate the neck, you need negative kinetic energy for the scalar. So the system is unstable. It has a ghost, okay? So I want to qualify this usually. The fact that stability implies the non-energy condition. Now, I want to stress that I want to neglect gravity for the moment, okay? This is a perfectly well-defined quantum field theory question about the stress-energy tensor of a Lorentz invariant quantum field theory, okay? And whatever we get this way will translate once we reintroduce gravity into an Einstein frame, if you want, statement, meaning if we have scalar fields around, there are ambiguities about what's the physical metric, let's say Jordan frame versus Einstein frame and so on. This will be an Einstein frame statement. So there's a fact concerning the neck that if you want to violate it, you need Lorentz to be spontaneously broken, simply because if T mu nu is proportional to eta mu nu, it saturates the neck, okay? So in order to violate it, you need spontaneous breaking of Lorentz. Whenever you have spontaneous breaking, you have Wollaston bosons, okay? As usual, the dynamics of Wollaston bosons is largely model independent. It's dictated by symmetry considerations. And so these are probably the guys that are going to be problematic if we want to violate the neck in a consistent way. So we're going to focus on those. Now, consider a system of scalars, okay? So this is an assumption. Yes. Yes. Because the cosmological constant. Yes. Exactly. Exactly. But what I'm saying is, yeah, this was just an aside comment about the fact that in any state that violates the null energy condition, there's going to be Wollaston bosons, okay? And you know that whenever you have spontaneous break, because of this spontaneous breaking, and whenever you have spontaneous breaking, yes. Yes. Well, in some broad sense, yes, there are gapless excitations. So, for instance, if a particle sits in empty space, it breaks spontaneously translations, and there are gapless excitations corresponding to moving the particle. Okay. I'm saying there is no energy gap in moving a particle sitting somewhere. This is a generalized Wollaston boson. Of course, it's less straightforward than usual because these are space-time symmetries. Excuse me? These are gauged, but that's why it's gap. That's why the excitation is gapless. That's why, I mean, it costs you arbitrary low energy to kick the particle. That's Goldstone's theorem. Yes. Anyway, we can talk about it. But yeah, I mean, it's mostly language, but if you want, it's a generalized version of Goldstone's argument. Of course, these are space-time symmetries, so it's trickier, but the existence of gapless excitation is there. Anyway, I'm not going to use directly this information. So consider a system of scalars, okay? And as usual, write down the low energy effective action as a derivative expansion. So there's going to be zero derivative terms, first derivative terms, and so on, okay? I'm assuming I have n scalars. Now, these are scalars, so this is a restricted somewhat system. On the other hand, one can show that the low energy dynamics of fluids and solids is of this form, okay? One can show that the effective theory for solids, sorry, this is not working very well. for fluids and solids is a set of derivatively coupled scalar. Okay, so it's a fairly general system. And at low energies, I want to stop at the first derivative level, because, as usual, at low energies, I stop at lowest order in the derivative expansion. Now, here's the statement. I look for some solution. I mean, I postulate that I have some solution, and I look for small perturbations about these solutions, okay? And I write down the quadratic Lagrangian for small perturbations about this solution, okay? So this is the solution that has a non-trivial gradient for my scalars, simply because I want to break Lorentz, otherwise I cannot violate the null energy condition, because if I don't break Lorentz, T mu nu is proportional to G mu nu. And by taking derivatives of the Lagrangian, so I decided to stop at lowest order in derivative expansion. So by taking derivatives of the Lagrangian with respect to the metric, I get the stress tensor. Fij is just the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to this matrix here. Okay? And whereas by taking derivatives with respect to the fields and their derivatives, I get the quadratic Lagrangian for small perturbations. And since I'm taking derivatives of the same object, F, with respect to two different things, but these two things, the metric and the fields, are somewhat related by the fact that the whole construction has to be Lorentz invariant, so indices have to be contracted somewhere, some way with the metric, okay? I get a relation between the stress energy tensor and the quadratic action for small perturbation. In particular, this object here, Fij, is the same appearing in the stress energy tensor. Of course, in the Lagrangian for perturbation, there is more stuff. For instance, there's a matrix of second derivatives of F with respect to this object here. Okay? Now, it turns out, so finding a link between the stress energy tensor computed about this solution and the quadratic action for small perturbations is non-trivial. Okay? It's a non-trivial algebraic problem. So it turns out that you can carry out a complete analysis, which is pretty boring. But you find the following statement, okay, that in this theory, so any system of scalars, you stop at first order in derivatives. Here's the statement. If you assume stability of your solution, and if you assume that your solution is either isotropic, which is the interesting case for cosmology, or it only carries subluminal excitations, then the null energy condition is a necessary consequence, okay? Your solution cannot violate the null energy condition. Meaning that if you want to reverse this error, if you want, let's negate the null energy condition, reverse this error, reverse this AND with an OR, and this OR with an AND. So if you want to violate the null energy condition, you have to give up either stability or both isotropy and subluminality, okay? So this is a fairly general statement that tells you how hard it is to violate the NEC in a consistent fashion. So if you don't like the conclusion, you have to give up some of the assumptions, okay? Stability, I mean that if I look at my solution and I look at the Lagrangian for small perturbations about it, the kinetic part, so let's forget about mass terms, because those, even if they are unstable, would correspond to slow instabilities. The kinetic part, I want it to be positive definite. So it's stability against ghost-like instabilities, if you want. So it's a UV stability. No, the opposite. I could have a, sorry, what violates what? Violates, No, because my criterion for stability focuses on the shortest distance in the theory, within the effective field theory. Okay? So if I violate that, my Hamiltonian is unbounded from below for short enough modes. Okay? So it's a weak form of stability, if you want. Meaning I'm not, for instance, I'm assuming that the mass terms could even be negative. I don't care. Because instabilities associated with negative mass terms are totally within the effective field. Could be, yeah. Exactly. So I'm assuming a weak form of stability. Yeah, so if you don't like the conclusions, you have to give up some of the assumptions, okay? So let's go back a couple of slides. There's not many assumptions here, okay? One assumption is that we are dealing with scalars. And I have to say, we didn't try to extend this to more higher spin, 10 minutes, thank you, to higher spin fields, because usually with higher spin fields, the structures of the consistent Lagrangians they can write down is even more constrained, so, but there could be a loophole here, okay? So we didn't go that way. But another assumption that is here is that at low energies we stop at lowest order in the derivative expansion. And that's usually what we do because, probably I have to hurry up, so I'll be quick, because simply both at the classical level and at the quantum mechanical level, if higher derivative terms become important, okay, they correspond to very problematic instabilities in the classical theory, okay, they correspond to ghosts, and quantum mechanically they correspond to a breakdown of the effective field theory. Now, there are two caveats I'm aware of to this logic. One is the ghost condensate, in which the system is degenerate at lowest order in the derivative expansion, but only as far as spatial derivatives are concerned. It means that certain higher derivative terms are important, but only for spatial derivatives, okay? And since the problem with ghosts is having too many time derivatives, this does not necessarily correspond to a breakdown of the classical theory. And quantum mechanically, you can check that the effective field theory is also well-defined when these higher derivative terms become important. And in fact, we use the ghost condensate with Leonardo and Paolo Creminelli to construct, for instance, bound solutions in the ghost condensate. I'm not going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about the other caveat I'm aware of, which is the Galilean. So the no-go theorem I just stated about the connection between stability and energy condition assumes that the Lagrangian has no higher derivative terms. On the other hand, at least the classical problem in having too many derivatives is at the level of the equation of motion. So this sounds like a cheap technical caveat, okay, but it may have non-trivial implications. So one question is, can one write down a Lagrangian which contains higher derivative terms, but that nonetheless produces two derivative equations of motion? I don't have time to go through the detail, but this is, if you want, the definition of the Galilean, which you can rephrase in terms of a certain invariance. And it turns out that in four dimensions, there's only five terms you can write down with this property. Okay, so I'm writing them down here in a compact form. Capital pi is the matrix of second derivatives, and the brackets are the trace of the matrix within, okay? And there is one term per order in the fields, okay? So there is a tadpole, there is the kinetic energy, a cubic interaction, quartic, and a quintic interaction, with non-trivial Lorentz contractions, okay? So the statement is that these are the only terms in four dimensions that once you compute the equations of motion, so they contain several derivatives, more than one derivative per field, okay? On the other hand, once you write down the equations of motion coming from these terms, the equations of motion contain purely two derivatives acting on each field, okay? No more and no less than two derivatives. It has nice quantum mechanical properties that I don't have time to review. The question is, can this system violate the null energy condition? Because it violates the assumptions of this no-go theorem. And so in principle, it could offer a counterexample. So it turns out that pretty much along the lines of what Justin was talking about yesterday, it's convenient to promote the Galilean symmetry, which I didn't have time to talk about. The Galilean symmetry is the statement that the symmetry is invariant not only under shifts of my fields, but also under a linear shift of my field. We called it Galilean because it reminds you of Galilean transformation in mechanics, whereby you shift x of t by a linear function of time, okay? So it turns out that it's more convenient to study cosmological solutions to promote this symmetry to actually the conformal group, okay? So this would be the analog of the shift symmetry. This would be the analog of the linear shift. But in fact, this is now with this change of coordinates, if you want. This is a scale transformation, and this is a spatial conformal transformation. That is to say, you promote this field to some sort of dilaton in which enters in some fake metric that you can use to construct invariants in a straightforward way. Turns out that it has the same good features as the Galilean, meaning the equations of motion contain at most two derivatives per field. So, like Justin was mentioning yesterday, thank you, just by symmetry you can get many properties of solutions in this model. So, for instance, the existence of a de Sitter-like solution in which the Udby-scale factor of this fake metric goes like 1 over t is guaranteed by symmetry because it corresponds to a breakdown of SO42 to SO41. So its existence is very robust. It doesn't involve any tuning. It just involves discrete choices like this parameter is larger than 0 rather than smaller than 0. Okay? So meaning that if you do other discrete choices, maybe you get spontaneous breaking of the conformal group down to the anti-de Sitter conformal group. But as long as you preserve many symmetries, the existence of solutions is pretty robust. And then from scale invariance plus conservation of the stress energy tensor, you can see right away that in this solution, the system has, I'm talking about solutions with zero gravity for now, okay? So the system in this solution has zero energy density and the pressure of the scale is like 1 over t to the fourth. And the question is, can that coefficient be negative, okay? If this can be negative, you violate the null energy condition. Moreover, since we start with zero energy, if you now introduce gravity, you are really describing a system which at t equals minus infinity has zero stress energy tensor, and so metric is flat, the real metric now is flat, and then since it has negative pressure, it will start expanding. So I have to run very quickly, okay? So the statement is that, yes, you can choose these Lagrangian coefficients appearing in the Galilean Lagrangian so that you can violate the neck without instabilities, okay? So you can check that fluctuations are exactly stable. Moreover, because of the symmetries that are unbroken by the solution, fluctuations are exactly luminal. And you'd be tempted to say that they are scale invariant, pretty much like along the lines of what Justin was saying yesterday. But in fact, it's tricky, okay? As we will see in a second. It's tricky to deduce a scale invariant spectrum from here. Is there a question? No. Okay. The real metric. Yes. Okay, but also in the fake, because the fake is just a conformal rescaling on the real. Now, if you turn on gravity, and you couple the system to gravity, you exactly describe the cosmology I was talking about. H dot scales like 1 over 2 to the fourth, positive, okay, so H rises from 0 to high values. On the other hand, gravitational couplings explicitly break the conformal invariance I'm using, so at some point, the solution will be modified, okay, and in particular, H will still scale like 1 over t cubed, but the conformal factor that was scaling like 1 over t now would scale like 1 over t squared after some critical time where gravitational back reaction become important. And in particular, when you approach zero time, there are certain invariants that appear in your Lagrangian, if you want, that exceed the strong coupling scale. So here we have an effective field theory with non-renormalizable interactions, so there is an intrinsic, thank you, strong coupling scale in the problem, okay? When you exceed that, the system becomes strongly coupled. Now, our assumption, of course, it's totally unsubstantiated, but our assumption is that that would correspond to reheating, meaning you reach a strong coupling scale, and all the energy that you have in this pi field gets converted into other degrees of freedom, which probably should be normal degrees of freedom, like, I don't know, photons, so that after that, the null energy condition cannot be violated anymore, okay? You lost all your null energy condition violating energy, and that corresponds to reheating and to the matching onto radiation dominance. Now, I should mention that, as I said, since this corresponds to strong coupling, we have no control over this reheating phase. On the other hand, strong coupling is associated with scales parametrically and arbitrarily lower than the Planck scale. So it's strong coupling for our matter fields. It's not strong coupling for gravity, okay? On the other hand, in the literature, there is a recent paper that has a weakly coupled interpretation of a reheating like this. Thank you. So I have 1 minute for probably 20 slides. So let me mention that the solution is an attractor, okay? Meaning that if you both at zero and then on zero k, if you start with mild deformations away from this solution, both contracting initial conditions and expanding initial conditions are driven towards our solution. So you solve the curvature problem. The study of scalar perturbations is tricky because it's true that we have a fake de Sitter metric. On the other hand, adiabatic perturbations are not fluctuations just in the scalar degree of freedom. They are just also fluctuations of the metric. So it turns out that they are very blue. On the other hand, as Justin was saying yesterday, isocurvature perturbations are, by conformal invariance, essentially forced to be scale invariant, okay? So the point is that Now you can have naturally a scale invariant spectrum of perturbation following just from symmetries, thank you. But you have to convert it later to adiabatic perturbations, okay? And this, as usual, involves some model dependence, meaning whenever you get adiabatic perturbations from isocurvature perturbation, the results are model dependent, okay? But the scale invariance is preserved, but for instance, the amplitude is model dependent. So let me skip to the problem. The problem of this model is superluminality, okay? So, as I said, in our fake De Sitter solution, excitations are exactly luminal. If you include gravitational back reaction, they are slightly subluminal. On the other hand, within the same effective field theory, there are very accessible solutions that feature superluminal excitations, okay? And it's a very strong statement that we're making here. So if you impose something like that pi-pi scattering obeys standard forward dispersion relations for the S matrix, okay, you're forced to this conclusion that if superluminality is outside of the effective theory, then the null energy condition solution, the null energy condition violating solution is also outside the effective theory. So they go together, okay? Now it turns out that you can, now I don't have time to explain the details, but you can disentangle these two properties, okay? And you can cure this problem, but here's what we have, okay? So if you want, this is my concluding slide. So, of all the properties that I listed at the beginning that I wanted to satisfy, okay, to satisfy, here are what I can satisfy. I have our cosmological solution that violates the null energy, first of all, it exists. It violates the null energy condition. It is stable against perturbations. It features strictly subluminal excitations, and not only that, but away from this solution, for mild deformation of the solutions, excitations are also subluminal. But I lose a pi equals zero solution, meaning in this theory, we found no way so far of having a Lorentz invariant ground state. Okay? So if you want, we have a very funny solution that obeys all the properties you'd like it to obey, so it's stable, subluminal, and so on, but it does not correspond, if you want, to a very funny solution in a theory that you can construct perturbatively around Minkowski. Okay? So this effective field theory, if you want, can only describe a state in which Lorentz symmetry is always spontaneously broken, pretty much like the Gauss condensate. Okay? So let me conclude with this, if you want, just 30 seconds. There is a recurrent connection between null energy condition and Lorentz invariance, or the relativistic structure of a theory. So here it is. In GR, the dominant energy condition, which is a close cousin of the null energy condition, is just a statement that the stress energy tensor does not have superluminal flow. Now, also in GR, if you assume the null energy condition for matter, this implies, under certain conditions, the absence of closed time-like curves. Our original Novo theorem says that if you assume you violate the null energy condition in a stable system, this implies that there are superluminal excitations in your system, okay? In the conformal Galileo I presented, certain solutions violate the NEC, others within the effective field theory are superluminal. In this deformed Galilean, which I didn't have time to mention in detail, and in the Gauss condensate, there are no superluminal excitations, so they both violate an energy condition. There are no superluminal excitations, but in both there is no Lorentz invariant vacuum. And so this connection, I'm not sure whether it's deep or accidental, but it's really there every time in different forms, and so I think it's something interesting to address. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sorry. I'm actually the other microphone runner. So it would seem tempting to try to interpret the present dark energy as this process, this runaway happening again. Is there a reason you're not trying to do that?
Say it again. Sorry, I couldn't.
It would seem tempting to try to interpret today's dark energy as maybe this runaway taking place again.
Yes.
Is there a reason that you are not? No,
it's you could do that. It's essentially the same physics, yes. Of course, at a much lower scale, but the same thing would apply. Yes, absolutely. So I'm not sure what the question is.
So it's observational evidence that your theory is happening again. You've gotten close to Minkowski space, and so it's running away again. It's not a question. It's I was just curious. I mean, the question the question was why was if there was some reason that you were only considering it prior to the Big Bang and not as the explanation for what's going on today. But
no, it's not. Indeed, the Galilean was originally introduced as a long distance modification of gravity. So if you want,
okay.
Apart from the from W less than minus one, let's say today, even just the acceleration, you can reproduce it in this theory. Yeah, at a much lower scale than this, of course. Yes.
Here. Okay. Yeah, I got confused towards the end. So do you get closed time-like curves?
No. Ah, by the way, sorry. I have to mention that I'm not sure whether... I believe the conclusions of the paper I'm going to mention now, and the authors also believe the conclusions. I'm not sure they do. But there's a recent paper by Jara, Evesling, and collaborators about closed time-like curves in the Galileo, meaning that in certain... So for certain choices of the coefficients of the Galilean Lagrangian, they do find the closed time-like curves. But they are not sure whether those are within the effective field theory. So, and I'm not sure either, because if they're not sure, why should I do? But that's certainly a possibility. But we didn't find any so far.
Maybe one last question.
Yeah.